You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. This week, we're facing the things that keep us tossing and turning in the middle of the night. All of my nightmares either involve teeth or tricky interpersonal situations. Our first story is about both of these things.
When I first used my housemate's toothbrush, it was an accident. See, I'd been struggling to wake all year, thanks to a combination of buzzing mosquitoes and a few relentless thoughts that lingered more than the February heat. None can be blown away by a $20 Kmart fan, so I'm usually still half asleep when getting ready for work, as I was a few months ago, staring at myself in the mirror, toothpaste coagulating around my mouth, dripping down the brush handle and into the sink. It was the latest of my many messes. Upstairs, half-drunken mugs of tea colonized every surface in my bedroom, from bedside table to bookshelf. Not the floor, though. That belonged to my clothes, shared by the many months of New Yorkers still in their plastic wrap. I would clean it all when I needed to, not necessarily when my clothes ran out or ants feasted on festering crumbs. The toothpaste scud slid down my hand and onto my arm. I considered if this small morning ritual of brushing my teeth could be the first step towards greater cleanliness. Physical, yes, but also ontological. I was concentrating on how I could feel myself change, tooth by tooth. It was only when I went to rinse that I realized the brush, which resembled mine to the touch, was not hot pink, but purple. Once I realized what I had done, my mind raced to examine the implications. Ethical, socio-political, dental. Maybe nothing, right? Housemates share things. A house, for starters, but also snacks, Netflix accounts, electricity bills. We even already shared toothpaste, something I, as the only person to buy toothpaste, had accepted long ago. Is it really crossing a line to share a toothbrush? But I couldn't pretend. I knew a line had been crossed. It was different. Our bodies had now been probed by the same stick. But whose body? I had no idea. And it was of utmost importance to find out. Could it be A or H? If needed, I could tell those two about the mishap at any moment, in text, in passing, during an ad break. I wouldn't need to sit them down or apologize. We would laugh it off, seeing it as a one-time mistake. But G enjoyed space, privacy, cleanliness. But did he enjoy the color purple? To be safe, I decided to never mention it. To leave no trace, I rinsed the brush with care, dried it with a hand towel, trying to remember which way the head faced when I picked it up from its holder next to the sink. All day, I found myself preparing for a potential confrontation. Would G instantly suspect me? Would he make a scene or plot a quiet vendetta? How would he know? Taste? Smell? Perhaps I'd brush the bristles too hard, their new shape speaking of someone else's mouth. I found myself treading lightly that night, staying in my room and resisting the need for water or food. When I heard G turn off his light, I headed to the bathroom. Grabbing my own toothbrush and squeezing the tube, I stared at my well-worn bristles, flattened out from the center by applying too much pressure, like twisted roots of a pot plant searching without aim for fertile ground. I had no idea how long I'd had it. 2 years, three. And just like that, I could no longer ignore what it was telling me. Like eating toast for dinner or not washing my sheets, it was a sign that I, no matter how much I pretended, did not really care about myself. But the purple toothbrush was pristine. Its owner must brush lightly, not motivated by a need to scrub away the day. It must be G's, who treated his body to morning stretches and home-cooked meals every night. I washed the toothpaste off the pink brush and put some on purple. I let the bristles caress my teeth slowly, imagining G counting 4 seconds for each tooth like he'd been taught as a child. Gradually, I felt the plaque break up like it does in the commercials, dissolving away to nothing. That night, I slept sound. I woke before my alarm for the first time in years. With time to spare, I did a load of washing, and before leaving for work, I took a chance with the purple brush again. I even used the tongue scraper, those little weird bumps on the back of brushes, and felt even better. I kept pushing further and further back until I gagged and spat up a glob of phlegm. It glowed green like cartoon toxic waste, leached from my body. That day, I spoke without the scratch in the back of my throat during meetings at work. My voice was soft and reasoned, like G's. I used his brush over the next week, morning and night. Each time I scraped my tongue, I imagined my taste buds resetting, my words now able to travel past without picking up old flavors. But with each brush, the bristles tasted more of myself, sickly metallic and familiar. It was clear I needed to let the purple brush recharge, to let G's spit settle. On the seventh day, I decided to try the green toothbrush. I sucked the bristles to see if I could detect a certain je ne sais quoi, and then applied the toothpaste. That day, I picked up the litter in my room and cancelled my New Yorker subscription. I even went for a jog. It wasn't too long, however, till my clarity clouded. As the power of the green toothbrush waned, I was confronted with a conundrum. By process of elimination, the two yet untouched brushes were H and her boyfriend's. Unfortunately, they were indiscernible to the taste, and I gained no reward from them. I began to panic. I decided to rotate between green and purple. I was resigning myself to red or black every third day to allow the others to regenerate. On bad days, I'd brush my teeth up to 5 times, which meant taking them to work and returning them before their owners could notice. I knew it was risky. I was being careless, but I didn't care. Not only was I destroying the delicate harmony of our share house, but I was destroying the brushes themselves. With each day, I felt less and less. Nothing could recreate the thrill and the danger of that first brush. Late one night, unable to sleep, I scoured the bathroom for alternatives. Soap, razors, shampoo. Nothing catches the essence of another person quite the same way. In the morning, after a shower, I noticed some underwear my housemate had forgotten to pick up on the bathroom floor. But they were too tight, and after a day of constant wedgies at work, it felt only the itch of disappointment. Then, 2 months into my journey, G messaged our group chat.
Hey, does anyone know where my toothbrush is gone? It's the purple one.
H replies.
Wait, which brush?
Then A says.
The purple one?
G.
Yeah, that's my brush.
A. No, that's mine.
H. What are you talking about?
Turns out the four of us had been using the same brush for months. Recently, I've returned to my own pink toothbrush, which has lost its metallic mouthfeel. Sometimes, I still switch it up. Now I'm staying overnight regularly at a boy's house. The first morning that I found myself in his bathroom, he offered me his electric toothbrush while he trimmed his beard. The vibration tickled my gums, and when I was done, he grabbed it from me. I stood with no reason to be there, with nothing to do but watch. He brushed his teeth with a childlike fury, the foam sliding out of his mouth and dropping down his arms. As he leant down to rinse, he paused to look at me in the mirror, standing behind him. He laughed and said, "This might be weird, but I think I can taste you."
That story was by Jared Richards. Sound design and original music composition by Pip Leeson. Eugenia Zubchenko was the supervising producer. A special thanks to Subbed In, where Jared read a draft of this story. And shout out to Jared's housemates. You all have great teeth. Maybe you have a higher tolerance for dental faux pas. Let's try something that's traditionally spooky. In the tiny town where my parents live, there's an urban legend. The legend goes that if you drive down the main road over 100 kilometres an hour after dark, with red P plates on, you'll see a ghost on a motorbike in the rearview mirror. I've always been too scared to try it out. Jen and Evie from the Northern Beaches in Sydney have their own hometown ghost story.
Growing up on the northern beaches of Sydney, there's always been this story about the Wakehurst Parkway.
The Wakehurst Parkway is a long, isolated stretch of road that runs for about 20 kilometres from Seaforth to Narrabeen.
A lot of people will tell you that this road is haunted. My name's Evie.
And my name's Jennifer. And we're going to find out if there's a ghost on the Wakehurst Parkway.
Starting route to Wakehurst Parkway. Head east on Short Street, then turn left onto Moonbee Street.
Evie and I met in high school. Our school was right around the corner from the Wakehurst Parkway. We used to drive past it every day.
But even though we've driven along it so many times and heard the story of the ghost, we've never seen it.
You just kind of think, it's just a local legend, right? We met with Michelle Richmond. She's a local historian.
We found out from Michelle that the area was notorious.
Well, there was just a body found on the Wakehurst Parkway. The guy called Jan Truba in 1972, and he was a local drug dealer. And, you know, sometimes the Wakehurst Parkway remoteness was probably a good place for doing deals, and his body was found there in 1972.
But we also found out the ghost stories and historians don't really gel.
Ghost stories, I would not know of any that any of us professional historians would say actually really existed, but I think it's a nice tale that people like to tell.
Okay, so it was about May 2016. It was a drizzly, misty sort of rainy night. It's just after 11 o'clock.
Have you ever been driving late at night and thought you saw something out of the corner of your eye? Is it your mind playing tricks on you, or is there someone watching you?
Brad North lives in French's Forest, not far from the Wakehurst Parkway, and he's seen a ghost.
I was driving home from Manly, and just before it hits the 80 kilometre sign, I saw this white sort of ghostly figure on the opposite side of the road. I started to slow down. It looked like somebody in an old uniform. It looked a bit like khaki, like a nurse's uniform. So I slowed down, wound down the window to have a look, just to say, are you okay, do you need some help? And I realised it was a very ghostly looking apparition. She wasn't looking at me, it was a female. And I thought, oh hell, that's a ghost. So I sped up and continued on my way back home to hear French's Forest.
This is Ruby Hardy. When driving home from work one night, she was 99.9% sure she saw a ghost.
I was like 99.9% sure that when I was driving, I saw a face in the rear view mirror. I'm sitting on the back seat, like some young girl, kind of like translucent-y. And then when I turned behind me, there was nothing there, and I looked back in the mirror and nothing was there. Then I got goosebumps and drove home.
I lived at Palm Beach with my parents when I was a young boy, and my father and I used to go down to Narrabeen Lakes to do prawning.
We met John Partridge in his home on the northern beaches. He said his house was haunted by spirits.
John's been seeing ghosts for a long time. When he was 5, maybe 6 years old, he saw ghosts on the Wakehurst Parkway.
And I can remember seeing a person, or an apparition or a person standing quite tall on this side and relatively short on the other side. And I think I remember saying to Dad, what's that? He went, oh my God, I don't know. And then we both sort of froze, but they certainly looked like people.
Beck Stewart-Wilson avoids driving down the Wakehurst Parkway because of a story about a ghost named Kelly.
So I live at one end of the parkway. My boyfriend lives on the other end. So driving to his house at 11 o'clock at night was just, that was a no-go. So I would go the long way. Kelly, this girl, will appear and she'll have all these injuries and she's quite bloody and, yeah, looks, you know, not good. She asks to get taken to Mernavale Hospital. So then whoever picks her up, yeah, frantically drives to the hospital and will get out and run to the hospital and say, oh my God, there's a girl called Kelly in my car. She has XYZ injuries. Please get help. And then the nurses will run out and she won't be there.
So maybe Kelly could be the ghost haunting the Wakehurst Parkway.
She's out to scare people when it comes to the Wakehurst Parkway. She enjoys that because she's been through a lot and she actually had a car accident on the Wakehurst Parkway. So when I see her, there is blood on her uniform, on the front of her dress, and she does have like a scrape on her knee and she also has a tear on the left-hand side of her uniform.
This is Michelle Vidler. She's a psychic, not to be confused with Michelle Richmond, the historian. She works under the name Hello Again Psychic and says that she can communicate with ghosts, such as Kelly.
Well, with Kelly, she was actually a nurse. And she, because I'd seen her many times going up and down the Wakehurst Parkway and she'd been in my car and I've had her have conversations at me, and I'm just, because her energy's just so strong and so forceful and it's not very nice. And she was saying that she would hear voices when she was here, and that she actually worked at the quarantine station. So she was a nurse. So that's why when people have seen her in the white dress, they're sort of thinking that it's a dress as such, but it's definitely not an actual dress, it's a uniform. And she, her name Kelly is actually short for a nickname because she actually was Irish originally.
So we're driving along the Wakehurst Parkway now. Evie, Michelle and I. Whereabouts are we headed, Michelle?
We're heading towards Deep Creek, and what we're going to do is we're going to sit down there and we're going to communicate with the spirits on Wakehurst Parkway. I'm going to channel them in and you're going to ask me lots of questions and I'm going to relay the messages of what the spirits are actually saying. They get to tell their side of the story for the first time ever. Other people have seen different things that have happened, but you've never really got those details from the spirits, have you?
So we've just pulled off the main parkway stretch and we're just driving into a little car park lot. The lake is kind of just in front of us and there's quite a bit of bushland around us at the moment. A bit of a reserve. During the day, this place would be full of people walking their dogs or using the lake kayaking. But at the moment, it's completely deserted. Why are we at this particular point?
Because prior to this session, I actually connected in with the spirits and I was told that they wanted me to meet them here.
Do they know we're here too?
Yes. They're standing over near the bench over there.
We couldn't see anything, but Michelle could see the ghosts as clear as day.
Although we never saw Kelly, she definitely could be out there, forever wandering the Wakehurst Parkway.
Evie Smythe and Jennifer Scherer produced that story. Sound design and original music composition by Reg Harris. The supervising producers were Nina Enova and Allison Chan. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you want to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us from anywhere in Australia. We also have a team of wonderful supervising producers to help you. Email contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Next up, Christopher Douglas Keller does something that would keep anyone up at night. He tries to make it in the music industry.
You're feeling all right?
It's an unseasonably warm winter night in downtown Nashville.
Make some noise if you're having a good time.
On Broadway, the bars have their doors wide open, letting the sound of live music waft over passers-by. Inside one of those bars, patrons are enjoying pizza and beer, along with the musical stylings of Christopher Douglas Keller and his band. Since he was a kid, Chris has loved music. He's played piano since he was six, started singing in junior high, he studied music and vocals at college, and alongside playing and making music, he's a vocal coach.
When your guitar player is just, he's doing something incredible and you hit this big power chord and you get this big, just sticking out and the bass is just rumbling and the drums just tight. There's this feeling that comes over you and you're just like, this is nirvana, you know, this is what it's all about.
If you love something that deeply, the expectation is that you'd take that love as far as you'd can. And that's what Chris wanted, to be a big star and to play to stadium audiences, to chase the American dream. But as everyone knows, the journey to the top isn't easy or straightforward. Chris has had to grapple with that and with what he thought he understood about success and failure.
I'll do the song Stars.
So, Chris has wanted to be a singer all his life.
Look down, go and bite your lip.
But there was a point when he was going to quit music. He was living in New York, playing music and doing vocal coaching. Then one day, he got a phone call. His younger brother had died.
I went through this phase of real fast. I was like, I'm done with music. I'm going to move back home. I'm going to be close to my family.
He also considered working for his friend out in Utah. His friend refused point blank.
I remember we were hanging out and he told me, he goes, no, I'm not going to hire you. I was like, why? You're making like a lot of money, like millions. I was like, you surely have enough space to hire a guy like me. And he goes, no. He's like, you need to do music. He's like, that's what you do.
Chris took those words to heart. He decided to double down on his ambitions. And not only that, take a new direction with his music. Before, Chris had been unfocused, playing across a bunch of genres with different bands. His brother's death gave him a new clarity. He was going to be a solo artist, and he was going to play alt country rock. Chris returned to Nashville in 2014. He worked hard to become a better musician, and his talent, it didn't go unnoticed. But while talent agents acknowledged that he was a good singer and had good songs, it wasn't enough.
And after the third time, I was just like, I don't get it. They tell me I don't have a drive and a passion. Like, I'm in my 30s and I have braces. Because I was like, I got to fix my teeth if I want to be a singer. I'm like, I got braces in my 30s. I practice guitar every day. I sing every day. I teach people how to sing. I teach people how to sing songs better. I teach people how to connect with music now more than ever. I used to teach them how to hit a note. Now I teach them how to sing.
What it boiled down to was the business part of the music business.
It used to be that way. You know, like, hey, I want to be a rock star. What are you going to do? Practice. You know, you better practice every day. Nowadays, it's like, hey, I want to be a rock star. What are you going to do? Well, let's talk about Instagram. Let's start doing more selfies. Let's make sure you start covering more pop songs. It seems to have reversed over the years.
All that stuff, it's not Chris. So he recalibrated. Over the past 4 years, Chris has realized that on his journey from obscurity to stardom, from A to C, you can stay at B. You don't have to keep going to C or drop back down to A.
As an American, you're like, it's the most proudest thing. I'm like the American dream. That's what we all live to do. But it's so easy to become very selfish with it. And it's very easy to also hate yourself, because if you don't achieve it, you failed. I didn't achieve my dream, then I failed.
Chris's dreams are now more modest than before. Now, his goal is just to enjoy making music and earn a living from it. And he's come to terms with the specifics of what B looks like, such as his digital sales numbers, which aren't quite where he'd want them. But that's okay.
You know, I look at the numbers. Oh, my numbers aren't where they want to be. Well, that's because I don't market myself well, and I know that. But even that, I look at it like, look what I've achieved. I've gotten to be in studios that they've recorded legendary albums. I've gotten to record vocals on a $12,000 microphone. I've gotten to play with musicians that have literally played stadiums and toured the world. I'm a very blessed person, and it is surreal, and I definitely don't tell myself that enough. I don't. But yes, would I say I've achieved the American dream? 100%. I just wanna see your name.
Ivana Ho produced that story, and Jordan Fennell was the supervising producer. This story was first made at the start of the year at the Transom Travelling Workshop in Nashville. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Alina Godwin. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Erin Dick. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe.